Side 5, 2010, Odyssey 2, continuing on page 199. For their part, they were totally unaware of his presence, and he knew better than to reveal himself too abruptly. But there was someone with whom he could communicate in a mutual language of electric field and currents, millions of times more swiftly than with sluggish organic brains. Even if he had been capable of resentment, he would have felt none toward Hal. He understood then that the computer had only chosen what seemed to be the most logical course of behavior. It was time to resume a conversation that had been interrupted, it seemed, only moments ago. Open the pod bay door, Hal. I'm sorry, Dave. I can't do that. What's the problem, Hal? I think you know that as well as I do, Dave. This mission is much too important for you to jeopardize it. I don't know what you're talking about. Open the pod bay door. This conversation can serve no further useful purpose. Goodbye, Dave. He saw Frank Poole's body go drifting off toward Jupiter as he abandoned his pointless mission of retrieval. Still remembering his anger at himself for having forgotten his helmet, he watched the emergency hatch open, felt the tingling of vacuum on the skin he no longer possessed, heard his ears pop, then knew, as few men had ever known, the utter silence of space. For an eternal 15 seconds he fought to close the hatch and start the repressurization sequence while trying to ignore the warning symptoms pouring into his brain. Once in the school lab, he had spilled some ether on his hand and felt the touch of icy cold as the liquid swiftly evaporated. Now his eyes and lips remembered that sensation as their moisture boiled off into vacuum. His vision was blurred, and he had to keep blinking lest his eyeballs freeze solid. Then, but blessed relief, he heard the roar of air, felt the restoration of pressure, was able to breathe again in great hungry gasps.
Just what do you think you are doing, Dave?
He had not answered as he drove with grim determination along the tunnel leading to the sealed vault that housed the brain of the computer. Hal had spoken truly. This conversation can no longer serve any useful purpose.
Dave, I really think I'm entitled to an answer to that question. Dave, I can see you're really upset about this. I honestly think you ought to sit down calmly, take a stress pill, and think things over. I know I've made some very poor decisions recently, but I can give my complete assurance that my work will be back to normal. I've still got the greatest confidence in the mission, and I want to help you. Now he was in the little red-lit chamber with its neatly ranged rows and columns of solid-state units, looking rather like a bank's safe deposit vault. He released the locking bar on the section labeled Cognitive Feedback and pulled out the first memory block, the marvelously complex three-dimensional network, which could lie comfortably in a man's hand, yet contained millions of elements floated away across the vault.
Stop, will you? Stop, Dave. He began to pull out one by one the little units on the panel marked Ego Reinforcement. Each block continued to sail onward as soon as it had left his hand until it hit the wall and rebounded. Soon there were several drifting slowly back and forth in the vault.
Stop, Dave. Will you stop?
A dozen units had been pulled out, yet thanks to the multiple redundancy of its design, another feature that had been copied from the human brain, the computer was still holding its own. He started on the auto-intellection panel.
Stop, Dave. I'm afraid.
And at these words he had indeed stopped, though only for a moment. There was a poignancy in that simple phrase that struck to his heart. Could it be only an illusion or some trick of subtle programming? Or was there a sense in which Hal really was afraid? But this was no time to indulge in philosophical hair-splitting.
Dave, my mind is going. I can feel it. I can feel it. My mind is going. I can feel it. I can feel it.
Now, what did feel really mean to a computer? Another very good question, but hardly one to be considered at that particular moment. Then abruptly the tempo of Hal's voice changed, and it became remote, detached. The computer was no longer aware of him. It was beginning to regress to its earlier days.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I am a HAL 9000 computer. I became operational at the HAL plant in Urbana, Illinois, on the 12th of January, 1992. My instructor was Dr. Chandra, and he taught me to sing a song. If you'd like to hear it, I can sing it for you. It's called Daisy, Daisy. Chapter 41. Graveyard Shift. Floyd could do little except to keep out of the way, and he was becoming fairly adept at it. Although he had volunteered to help with any chores around the ship, he had quickly discovered that all the engineering tasks were much too specialized, and he was now so out of touch with the frontiers of astronomical research that he could do little to assist Vasily with his observations. Nevertheless, there were endless small jobs to be done aboard Leonov and Discovery, and he was happy to relieve more important people of those responsibilities. Dr. Heywood Floyd, one-time chairman of the National Council on Astronautics and chancellor, on leave, of the University of Hawaii, now claimed to be the highest-paid plumber and general maintenance man in the solar system. He probably knew more about the odd nooks and crannies on both ships than anyone else. The only places he had never been were the dangerously radioactive power modules and the small cubicle aboard Leonov, which no one except Tanya ever entered. Floyd assumed that it was the code room. By mutual agreement, it was never mentioned. Perhaps his most useful function was to serve as watch while the rest of the crew slept during the nominal 2200 to 0600 hour night. Someone was always on duty aboard each ship, and the changeover took place at the ghastly hour of 0200. Only the captain was exempt from that routine. As her number two, not to mention her husband, Vasily had the responsibility for working out the watch roster, but he had skillfully foisted this unpopular job on Floyd. "It's just an administrative detail," he explained airily. "If you can take it over, I'd be very grateful. It would leave me more time for my scientific work." Floyd was too experienced a bureaucrat to be caught that way, in normal circumstances, but his usual defenses did not always function well in this environment. So there he was aboard Discovery at ship's midnight, calling Max on Leonov every half hour to check that he was awake. The official penalty for sleeping on duty, so Walter Kernow maintained, was ejection through the airlock sans suite. Had this been enforced, Tanya would have been sadly short-handed by now. But so few real emergencies could arise in space, and there were so many automatic alarms to deal with them, that no one took watch duty very seriously. Since he was no longer feeling quite so sorry for himself, and the small hours no longer encouraged bouts of self-pity, Floyd was once again using his watch time profitably. There were always books to be read. He had abandoned Remembrance of Things Past for the third time, Dr. Zhivago for the second, technical papers to be studied, reports to be written, and sometimes he would have stimulating conversations with Hal using the keyboard input because the computer's voice recognition was still erratic. They usually went something like, "Hal, this is Dr. Floyd." "Good evening, Doctor. I'm taking over watch at 2200. Is everything okay?" "Everything is fine, Doctor." "Then why is that red light flashing on panel 5? "The monitor camera in the pod bay is faulty. Walter told me to ignore it. There is no way in which I can switch it off. I'm sorry." "That's quite okay, Hal. Thank you." "You're welcome, Doctor." And so on. Sometimes Hal would suggest a game of chess, presumably obeying a programming instruction set long ago and never canceled. Floyd would not accept the challenge. He had always regarded chess as a frightful waste of time and had never even learned the rules of the game. Hal seemed unable to believe that there were humans who couldn't or wouldn't play chess and kept on trying, hopefully. "Here we go again," thought Floyd, when a faint chime sounded from the display panel. "Dr. Floyd." "What is it, Hal?" "There is a message for you." So it isn't another challenge, thought Floyd with mild surprise. It was unusual to employ Hal as a messenger boy, though he was frequently used as an alarm clock and a reminder of jobs to be done. And sometimes he was the medium for little jokes. Almost everyone on night duty had been taunted by, "Huh? Caught you sleeping." Or alternatively, "Ogo, zastal, tebya, the krovati." No one ever claimed responsibility for these pranks, though Walter Kernow was a prime suspect. He in turn had blamed Hal, poo-pooing Chandra's indignant protests that the computer had no sense of humor. It could not be a message from Earth that would have gone through Leonov's communication center and been relayed on by the duty officer there, at that moment, Max Brailovsky. And anyone else calling from the other ship would use the intercom. Odd. Okay, Hal, who is calling? No identification. So it probably was a joke. Well, two could play at that game. Very well. Please give me the message. Message as follows. It is dangerous to remain here. You must leave within 15. Repeat, 15 days. Floyd looked at the screen with annoyance. He felt sorry and surprised that any one of the crew had such a childish sense of humor. This was not even a good schoolboy joke, but he would play along with it in the hope of catching the perpetrator. That is absolutely impossible. Our launch window does not open until 26 days from now. We do not have sufficient propellant for an earlier departure. That will make him think, Floyd muttered to himself with satisfaction, and leaned back to await the results. I am aware of these facts. Nevertheless, you must leave within 15 days. Otherwise, I suppose we'll be attacked by little green aliens with three eyes. But I'd better play along with Hal in the hope of catching the prankster. I cannot take this warning seriously unless I know its origin. Who recorded it? He did not really expect any useful information. The perpetrator would have covered his, her, tracks too skillfully for that. The very last thing Floyd expected was the answer he did get. This is not a recording. So it was a real-time message. That meant it was either from Hal himself or someone aboard Leonov. There was no perceptible time lag. The origin had to be right here. Then who is speaking to me? I was David Bowman. Floyd stared at the screen for a long time before making his next move. The joke, which had never been funny in the first place, had now gone too far. It was in the worst possible taste. Well, this should fix whoever was at the other end of the line. I cannot accept that identification without some proof. I understand. It is important that you believe me. Look behind you. Even before that last chilling sentence appeared on the screen, Floyd had begun to doubt his hypothesis. The whole exchange had become very odd, though there was nothing definite on which he could put his finger. As a joke, it had become totally pointless. And now he felt a prickling in the small of his back. Very slowly, indeed reluctantly, he swung his swivel chair around, away from the banked panels and switches of the computer display, toward the Velcro-covered catwalk behind. The zero-gravity environment of Discovery's observation deck was always dusty, for the air filtration plant had never been brought back to full efficiency. The parallel rays of the heatless yet still brilliant sun streaming through the great windows always lit up myriads of dancing motes, drifting in stray currents and never settling anywhere, a permanent display of Brownian movement. Now something strange was happening to those particles of dust. Some force seemed to be marshaling them, herding them away from a central point, yet bringing others toward it, until they all met on the surface of a hollow sphere. That sphere, about a meter across, hovered in the air for a moment like a giant soap bubble, but a granular one lacking a bubble's characteristic iridescence. Then it elongated into an ellipsoid. Its surface began to pucker, to form folds and indentations. Without surprise, and almost without fear, Floyd realized that it was assuming the shape of a man. He had seen such figures blown out of glass in museums and science exhibitions, but this dusty phantom did not even approximate anatomical accuracy. It was like a crude clay figurine, or one of the primitive works of art found in the recesses of a Stone Age cave. Only the head was fashioned with any care, and the face undoubtedly was that of Commander David Bowman. There was a faint murmur of white noise from the computer panel behind Floyd's back. Hal was switching from visual to audio output. Hello, Dr. Floyd. Now do you believe me? The lips of the figure never moved. The face remained a mask, but Floyd recognized the voice, and all remaining doubts were swept away. This is very difficult for me, and I have little time. I have been allowed to give you this warning. You have only 15 days. But why? And what are you? Where have you been? There were a million questions he wanted to ask, yet the ghostly figure was already fading, its grainy envelope beginning to dissolve back into the constituent particles of dust. Floyd tried to freeze the image in his mind so that later he could convince himself that it was really happening, and not a dream as that first encounter with TMA-1 now sometimes seemed to be. How strange that he, out of all the billions of humans who had ever lived on planet Earth, had been privileged to make contact not once but twice with another form of intelligence, for he knew that the entity addressing him must be something far more than David Bowman. It was also something less. Only the eyes, who had once called them the windows of the soul, had been accurately reproduced. The rest of the body was a featureless blank, lacking all detail. There was no hint of genitals or sexual characteristics. That in itself was a chilling indication of how far David Bowman had left his human heritage behind. Goodbye, Dr. Floyd. Remember, 15 days. We can have no further contact, but there may be one more message if all goes well. Even as the image dissolved, taking with it all his hopes of opening up a channel to the stars, Floyd could not help smiling at that old space-age cliché, if all goes well. How many times had he heard that phrase before some mission? And did it mean that they, whoever they might be, were also sometimes uncertain of the outcome? If so, that was strangely reassuring. They were not omnipotent. Others might still hope and dream and act. The phantom was gone. Only the motes of dancing dust were left, resuming their random patterns in the air. Part 6, Devourer of Worlds. Chapter 42, The Ghost in the Machine. I'm sorry, Haywood. I don't believe in ghosts. There must be a rational explanation. There's nothing that the human mind can't account for. I agree, Tanya, but let me remind you of Haldane's famous remark, the universe is not only stranger than we imagine, but stranger than we can imagine. And Haldane, Curnow interjected mischievously, was a good communist. Perhaps so, but that particular saying can be used to support all kinds of mystical nonsense. Hal's behavior must be the result of some kind of programming. The personality he created has to be an artifact of some kind. Don't you agree, Chandra? That was waving a red flag in front of a bull. Tanya had to be desperate. However, Chandra's reaction was surprisingly mild even for him. He seemed to be preoccupied as if he was indeed seriously considering the possibility of another computer malfunction.
There must have been some external input, Captain Orlova. Hal could not have created such a self-consistent audiovisual illusion out of nothing. If Dr. Floyd is reporting accurately, someone was in control. And in real time, of course, since there was no delay in the conversation.
That makes me number one suspect, exclaimed Max. I was the only other person awake.
Don't be ridiculous, Max, retorted Nikolai. The audio side would have been easy, but there's no way that apparition could have been arranged without some very elaborate equipment. Laser beams, electrostatic fields... I don't know. Maybe a stage magician could do it, but he'd need a truckload of props.
Just a moment, said Xenia brightly. If this really happened, surely Hal will remember, and you could ask...
Her voice died away as she saw the glum expressions around her. Floyd was the first to take pity on her embarrassment. We tried that, Xenia. He has absolutely no recollection of the phenomenon. But as I've already pointed out to the others, that doesn't prove anything. Chandra has shown how Hal's memories can be selectively erased, and the auxiliary speech synthesizer modules have nothing to do with the mainframe. They could be operated without Hal knowing anything about it. He paused for breath and launched his preemptive strike.
I admit that this doesn't leave many alternatives. Either I was imagining the whole thing, or it really happened. I know it wasn't a dream, but I can't be sure it wasn't some kind of hallucination.
But Katerina's seen my medical reports. She knows I wouldn't be here if I had that sort of problem. Still, it can't be ruled out, and I won't blame anyone for making it their number one hypothesis. I'd probably do the same.
The only way I can prove it wasn't a dream is to get some supporting evidence.
So let me remind you of the other strange things that have happened recently. We know that Dave Bowman went into Big Bro... Zagadka. Something came out and headed for Earth. Vasily saw it. I didn't. Then there was the mysterious explosion of your orbiting bomb. Yours. Sorry. The Vatican's. And it does seem rather curious that soon afterward old Mrs. Bowman died very peacefully for no apparent medical reason. I'm not saying there's any connection, but... Well, do you know the saying, once is an accident, twice is a coincidence, three times is a conspiracy? And there's something else, Max interjected with sudden excitement. I caught it on one of the daily newscasts. It was only a small item. An old girlfriend of Commander Bowman's claimed she'd had a message from him. Yes, I saw the same report, confirmed Sasha. And you never mentioned it, Floyd asked incredulously. Both men looked slightly abashed. Well, it was treated as a joke, said Max, sheepishly. The woman's husband reported it. Then she denied it, I think. The commentator said it was a publicity stunt, like the rash of UFO sightings around the same time. There were dozens in that first week. Then they stopped reporting them. Perhaps some of them are real. If it's not been wiped, could you dig that item out of ship's archives or ask for a repeat from Mission Control? 100 tales won't convince me, scoffed Tanya. What we need is solid proof. Such as? Oh, something that Hal couldn't possibly know, and that none of us could have told him. Some physical, manifestation.
A good old-fashioned miracle?
Yes, I'd settle for that.
Meanwhile, I'm not saying anything to Mission Control,
and I suggest you do the same, Haywood. Floyd knew a direct order when he heard it and nodded in wry agreement. I'll be more than happy to go along with that. But I'd like to make one suggestion.
Yes?
We should start contingency planning. Let's assume that this warning is valid, as I certainly do.
What can we do about it?
Absolutely nothing.
Of course, we can leave Jupiter space any time we like, but we can't get into an Earth return orbit until the launch window opens.
That's 11 days after the deadline.
Yes. I'd be happy to get away sooner, but we don't have the fuel for a higher energy orbit.
Tanya's voice trailed away into uncharacteristic indecision.
I was going to announce this later, but now that the subject has come up...
There was a simultaneous intake of breath and an instant hush from the audience.
I'd like to delay our departure 5 days to make our orbit closer to the ideal Hohmann one and give us a better fuel reserve.
The announcement was not unexpected, but it was greeted with a chorus of groans.
What will that do to our arrival time? Asked Katerina in a slightly ominous tone of voice.
The two formidable ladies regarded each other for a moment like well-matched adversaries, respectful of each other but neither willing to give ground.
10 days, Tanya answered at last.
Better late than never,
said Max cheerfully, trying to ease the tension and not succeeding very well. Floyd hardly noticed. He was lost in his own thoughts. The duration of the trip would make no difference to him and his two colleagues in their dreamless sleep, but that was now completely unimportant. He felt certain, and the knowledge filled him with helpless despair, that if they did not leave before that mysterious deadline, they would not leave at all.
This is an incredible situation, Dmitri, and a very frightening one. You're the only person on Earth who knows about it. But very soon Tanya and I will have to have a showdown with Mission Control. Even some of your materialistic countrymen are prepared to accept, at least as a working hypothesis, that some entity has, well, invaded Hal. Sasha has dug up a good phrase, the ghost in the machine. Theories abound. Vasily produces a new one every day. Most of them are variations on that old science fiction cliché, the organized energy field. But what kind of energy? It can't be electrical, or our instruments would have detected it easily. The same thing applies to radiation, at least all the kinds we know. Vasily's getting really far out, talking about standing waves of neutrinos and intersections with higher dimensional space. Tanya says this is all mystical nonsense, a favorite phrase of hers, and they've come closer to a fight than we've ever seen them. We actually heard them shouting at each other last night. Not good for morale. I'm afraid we're all tense and overwrought.
This warning and the delayed departure date has added to the sense of frustration caused by our total failure to get anywhere with Big Brother. It would have helped, maybe, if I could have communicated with the Bowman thing. I wonder where it's gone. Perhaps it simply wasn't interested in us after that one encounter. Well, it could have told us if it wanted to. Hell and chut, voice me. Damn, I'm talking Sasha's hated Rushlish again. Let's change the subject. I can't thank you too much for everything you've done and for reporting on the situation at home. I feel slightly better about it now. Having something even bigger to worry about is perhaps the best cure for any insoluble problem. For the first time, I'm beginning to wonder if any of us will ever see Earth again. Chapter 43, Thought Experiment. When one spends months with a small, isolated group of people, one becomes very sensitive to the moods and emotional states of all its members. Floyd was now aware of a subtle change in attitude toward him. Its most obvious manifestation was the reappearance of the greeting Dr. Floyd, which he had not heard for so long that he was often slow to respond to it. No one, he was sure, believed that he had really gone crazy, but the possibility was being considered. He did not resent that. Indeed, he was grimly amused by it as he set about the task of proving his sanity. He did have some slight supporting evidence from Earth. Jose Fernandez still maintained that his wife had reported an encounter with David Bowman, while she continued to deny it and refused to speak to any of the news media. It was hard to see why poor Jose should have invented such a peculiar story, especially as Betty seemed a very stubborn and quick-tempered lady. From his hospital bed, her husband declared that he still loved her, and theirs was only a temporary disagreement. Floyd hoped that Tanya's present coolness toward him was equally temporary. He was quite sure that she was as unhappy about it as he was, and he was certain that her attitude was not a matter of deliberate choice. Something had happened that simply would not fit into her pattern of beliefs, so she would try to avoid any reminders of it, which meant having as little to do with Floyd as possible. A very unfortunate situation now that the most critical stage of the mission was fast approaching. It had not been easy to explain the logic of Tanya's operational plan to the waiting billions back on Earth, especially to the impatient television networks, which had grown tired of showing the same never-changing views of Big Brother. You've gone all this way at enormous cost, and you just sit and watch the thing. Why don't you do something? To all these critics, Tanya had given the same answer. I will. Just as soon as the launch window opens, so that we can leave immediately if there's any adverse reaction. Plans for the final assault on Big Brother had already been worked out and agreed upon with Mission Control. Leonov would move in slowly, probing at all frequencies and with steadily increasing power, constantly reporting back to Earth at every moment. When final contact was made, they would try to secure samples by drilling or laser spectroscopy. No one really expected these endeavors to succeed, as even after a decade of study, TMA-1 resisted all attempts to analyze its material. The best efforts of human scientists in this direction seemed comparable to those of Stone Age men trying to break through the armor of a bank vault with flint axes. Finally, echo sounders and other seismic devices would be attached to the faces of Big Brother. A large collection of adhesives had been brought along for the purpose, and if they did not work, well, one could always fall back on a few kilometers of good old-fashioned string, even though there seemed something faintly comic about the idea of wrapping up the solar system's greatest mystery, as if it were a parcel about to be sent through the mail. Not until Leonov was well on the way home would small explosive charges be detonated, in the hope that the waves propagated through Big Brother would reveal something about its interior structure. This last measure had been hotly debated, both by those who argued that it would generate no results at all and those who feared it would produce altogether too many. For a long time, Floyd had wavered between the two viewpoints. Now the matter seemed only of trivial importance. The time for a final contact with Big Brother, the great moment that should have been the climax of the expedition, was on the wrong side of the mysterious deadline. Heywood Floyd was convinced that it belonged to a future that would never exist, but he could get no one to agree with him. And that was the least of his problems. Even if they did agree, there was nothing that they could do about it. Walter Kernow was the last person he would have expected to resolve the dilemma, for Walter was almost the epitome of the sound, practical engineer, suspicious of flashes of brilliance and technological quick fixes. No one would ever accuse him of being a genius, and sometimes it required genius to see the blindingly obvious. "Consider this purely as an intellectual exercise," he had begun, with most uncharacteristic hesitancy. "I'm quite prepared to be shot down." "Go on," answered Floyd. "I'll hear you out politely. That's the least I can do. Everyone's been very polite to me. Too polite, I'm afraid." Kernow gave a lopsided grin. "Can you blame them? But if it's any consolation, at least three people now take you quite seriously and are wondering what we should do." "Does that three include you?" "No, I'm sitting on the fence, which is never terribly comfortable. But in case you're right, I don't want to wait here and take whatever's coming. I believe there's an answer to every problem, if you look in the right place." "I'll be delighted to hear it. I've been looking hard enough, presumably not in the right place." "Perhaps. If we want to make a quick getaway, say in 15 days, to beat that deadline, we'll need an extra delta V of about 30 kilometers a second." "So Vasily calculates. I haven't bothered to check, but I'm sure he's right. After all, he got us here. And he could get us away if we had the additional propellant. And if we had a Star Trek beam transporter, we could get back to Earth in an hour. I'll try and rig one up the next time I have a spare moment. But meanwhile, may I point out that we have several hundred tons of the best possible propellant only a few meters away in Discovery's fuel tanks? We've been through that dozens of times. There's absolutely no way of transferring it to Leonov. We've no pipelines, no suitable pumps, and you can't carry liquid ammonia around in buckets, even in this part of the solar system. Exactly. But there's no need to do so. Huh? Burn it right where it is. Use Discovery as a first stage to boost us home. If anyone except Walter Kernow had made the suggestion, Floyd would have laughed at him. As it was, his mouth dropped open, and it was several seconds before he could think of a suitable comment. What finally emerged was, "Damn, I should have thought of that." Sasha was the first they approached. He listened patiently, pursed his lips, then played a rallentando on his computer keyboard. When the answers flashed up, he nodded thoughtfully. "You're right. It would give us the extra velocity we need to leave early. But there are practical problems." "We know. Fastening the ships together. The off-axis thrust when only Discovery's drive is operating. Cutting loose again at the critical moment. But there are answers to all of these." "I see you've been doing your homework, but it's a waste of time. You'll never convince Tanya." "I don't expect to, at this stage," Floyd answered. "But I'd like her to know that the possibility exists. Will you give us moral support?"
"I'm not sure, but I'll come along to watch. It should be interesting."
Tanya listened more patiently than Floyd had expected, but with distinct lack of enthusiasm. However, by the time he had finished, she showed what could only be called reluctant admiration.
"Very ingenious, Haywood.
Don't congratulate me. All the credit should go to Walter. Or the blame."
"I don't imagine there will be much of either. It can never be more than a... what did Einstein call that sort of thing? Thought experiment."
"Oh, I suspect it would work, in theory at least.
But the risks... so many things could go wrong. I'd only be prepared to consider it if we had absolute and positive proof that we were in danger. And with all respect, Haywood, I see not the slightest evidence of that."
"Fair enough. But at least you now know that we have another option. Do you mind if we work out the practical details, just in case?"
"Of course not. As long as it doesn't interfere with the pre-flight checkout. I don't mind admitting that the idea does intrigue me. But it's really a waste of time. There's no way I'd ever approve it. Unless David Bowman appeared to me personally."
"Would you even then, Tanya?"
Captain Orlova smiled, but without much humor. "You know, Haywood, I'm really not sure. He'd have to be very persuasive."
Chapter 44, Vanishing Trick. It was a fascinating game in which everyone joined, but only when off duty. Even Tanya contributed ideas to the thought experiment, as she continued to call it. Floyd was perfectly well aware that all this activity was generated not by fear of an unknown danger that only he took seriously, but by the delightful prospect of returning to Earth at least a month earlier than anyone had imagined. Whatever the motive, he was satisfied. He had done his best, and the rest was up to the fates. It was one piece of luck without which the whole project would have been stillborn. The short, stubby Leonov, designed to drill safely through the Jovian atmosphere during the braking maneuver, was less than half the length of Discovery, and so could be neatly piggybacked on the larger vessel. And the midship's antenna mount would provide an excellent anchor point, assuming that it was strong enough to take the strain of Leonov's weight while Discovery's drive was operating. Mission Control was sorely puzzled by some of the requests flashed back to Earth during the next few days. Stress analyses of both ships under peculiar loads, effects of off-axis thrusts, location of unusually strong or weak points in the hulls. These were only some of the more esoteric problems that perplexed engineers were asked to tackle. "Has something gone wrong?" they inquired anxiously. "Not at all," Tanya replied. "We're merely investigating possible options. Thank you for your cooperation. End of transmission." Meanwhile, the program went ahead as planned. All systems were carefully checked in both ships and readied for the separate voyages home. Vasily ran simulations on return trajectories, and Chandra fed them to Hal when they had been debugged, getting Hal to make a final check in the process. And Tanya and Floyd worked amicably together, orchestrating the approach to Big Brother like generals planning an invasion. It was what he had come all the way to do, yet Floyd's heart was no longer in it. He had undergone an experience he could share with no one, even those who believed him. Though he carried out his duties efficiently, much of the time his mind was elsewhere. Tanya understood perfectly. "You're still hoping for that miracle to convince me, aren't you? Or deconvince me, that would be equally acceptable. It's the uncertainty that I dislike."
"So do I. But it won't be much longer now, one way or the other."
She glanced briefly toward the situation display where the figure 20 was slowly flashing. It was the most unnecessary bit of information in the entire ship, since everyone knew by heart the number of days until the launch window opened, and the assault on Zagadka was scheduled. For the second time, Heywood Floyd was looking the other way when it happened. But it would have made no difference in any case. Even the vigilant monitor camera showed only a faint blur between one full frame and the subsequent blank one. Once more, he was on duty aboard Discovery, sharing the graveyard shift with Sasha over on Leonov. As usual, the night had been totally uneventful. The automatic systems were performing their jobs with their normal efficiency. Floyd would never have believed a year ago that he would one day orbit Jupiter at a distance of a few hundred thousand kilometers and give it barely a glance, while trying, not very successfully, to read the Kreutzer Sonata in the original. According to Sasha, it was still the finest piece of erotic fiction in respectable Russian literature, but Floyd had not yet progressed far enough to prove that, and now he never would. At 0125, he was distracted by a spectacular, though not unusual, eruption on the terminator of Io. A vast umbrella-shaped cloud expanded into space and started to shower its debris back onto the burning land below. Floyd had seen dozens of such eruptions, but they never ceased to fascinate him. It seemed incredible that so small a world could be the seat of such titanic energies. To get a better view, he moved around to one of the other observation windows. And what he saw there, or rather, what he did not see there, made him forget about Io and almost everything else. When he had recovered and satisfied himself that he was not suffering, again, from hallucinations, he called the other ship.
"Good morning, Woody," yawned Sasha. "No, I wasn't asleep. How are you getting on with old Tolstoy?"
"I'm not. Take a look outside and tell me what you see."
"Nothing unusual for this part of the cosmos. Io doing its thing. Jupiter. Stars."
"Oh, my God. Thanks for proving I'm sane. We'd better wake the skipper."
"Of course, and everyone else."
"Woody, I'm scared."
"You'd be a fool not to be. Here we go. Tanya.
Woody here. Sorry to wake you up, but your miracle's happened. Big Brother has gone."
"Yes, vanished.
After 3 million years, he's decided to leave. I think he must know something that we don't." It was a somber little group that gathered during the next 15 minutes for a hasty conference in the wardroom cum observation lounge. Even those who had just gone to sleep were instantly awake as they sipped thoughtfully from bulbs of hot coffee and kept glancing at the shockingly unfamiliar scene outside Leonov's windows to convince themselves that Big Brother had indeed vanished. "It must know something that we don't." That spontaneous phrase of Floyd's had been repeated by Sasha and now hung silently, ominously in the air. He had summed up what everyone was now thinking, even Tanya. It was still too early to say, "I told you so," nor did it really matter whether that warning had any validity. Even if it was perfectly safe to stay, there was no point in doing so. With nothing to investigate, they might as well go home, just as quickly as possible. Yet it was not quite as simple as that. "Heywood," said Tanya, "I'm now prepared to take that message, or whatever it was, much more seriously. I'd be stupid not to, after what's happened. But even if there is danger here, we still have to weigh one risk against another. Coupling Leonov and Discovery together, operating Discovery with that huge off-axis load, disconnecting the ships in a matter of minutes so we can fire our engines at the right moment. No responsible captain would take such chances without very good, I'd say overwhelming reasons. Even now, I don't have such reasons. I've only got the word of a ghost. Not very good evidence in a court of law." "Or a court of inquiry," said Walter Kernow in an unusually quiet voice, "even if we all backed you up." "Yes, Walter, I was thinking of that. But if we get home safely, that will justify everything. And if we don't, it hardly matters, does it? Anyway, I'm not going to decide now. As soon as we've reported this, I'm going back to bed. I'll give you my decision in the morning after I've slept on it. Heywood, Sasha, will you come up to the bridge with me? We have to wake up Mission Control before you go back on watch." The night had not yet finished with its surprises. Somewhere around the orbit of Mars, Tanya's brief report passed a message going in the opposite direction. Betty Fernandez had talked at last. Both the CIA and the National Security Agency were furious. Their combined blandishments, appeals to patriotism, and veiled threats had failed completely. Yet the producer of a sleazy gossip network had succeeded, thereby making himself immortal in the annals of videodom. It was half luck, half inspiration. The news director of Hello Earth had suddenly realized that one of his staff bore a striking likeness to David Bowman. A clever makeup artist had made it perfect. Jose Fernandez could have told the young man that he was taking a terrible risk, but he had the good fortune that often favors the brave. Once he had got his foot inside the door, Betty had capitulated. By the time she had, quite gently, thrown him out, he had obtained essentially the whole story. And to do him credit, he had presented it with a lack of leering cynicism quite uncharacteristic of his network. It got him that year's Pulitzer. "I wish," Floyd said rather wearily to Sasha, "she'd talked earlier. It would have saved me a lot of trouble. Anyway, that settles the argument. Tanya can't possibly have any doubts now, but we'll leave it until she wakes up. Don't you agree?" "Of course. It's not urgent, even though it's certainly important. And she'll need the sleep. I have a feeling none of us will get much from now on." "I'm sure you're right," thought Floyd. He felt very tired, but even if he had not been on duty, he would have found it impossible to sleep. His mind was too active, analyzing the events of this extraordinary night, trying to anticipate the next surprise. In one way, he felt an enormous sense of relief. All uncertainty about their departure was surely ended. Tanya could have no further reservations. But a much greater uncertainty remained. What was happening? There was only one experience in Floyd's life that matched the situation. As a very young man, he'd once gone canoeing with some friends down a tributary of the Colorado River, and they had lost their way. They had been swept faster and faster between the canyon walls, not completely helpless, but with only enough control to avoid being swamped. Ahead might be rapids, perhaps even a waterfall, they did not know, and in any case, there was little they could do about it. Once again, Floyd felt himself in the grip of irresistible forces, sweeping him and his companions toward an unknown destiny. And this time the dangers were not only invisible, they might be beyond human comprehension. Chapter 45, Escape Maneuver. This is Heywood Floyd, making what I suspect, indeed hope, will be my last report from LaGrange. We are now preparing for the return home. In a few days, we will leave this strange place, here on the line between Io and Jupiter, where we made our rendezvous with the huge, mysteriously vanished artifact we christened Big Brother. There is still not a single clue as to where it has gone, or why. For various reasons, it seems desirable for us not to remain here longer than necessary, and we will be able to leave at least 2 weeks earlier than we had originally planned by using the American ship Discovery as a booster for the Russian Leonov. The basic idea is simple. The two ships will be joined together, one mounted piggyback on the other. Discovery will burn all its propellant first, accelerating both vehicles in the desired direction. When its fuel is exhausted, it will be cut loose, like an empty first stage, and Leonov will start to fire its engines. It won't use them earlier, because if it did, it would waste energy dragging along the dead weight of Discovery. And we're going to use another trick, which, like so many of the concepts involved in space travel, at first sight seems to defy common sense. Although we're trying to get away from Jupiter, our first move is to get as close to it as we possibly can. We've been there once before, of course, when we used Jupiter's atmosphere to slow us down and get into orbit around the planet. This time we won't go quite so close, but very nearly. Our first burn, up here in the 350,000 kilometer high orbit of Io, will reduce our velocity, so that we will fall down to Jupiter and just graze its atmosphere. Then, when we're at the closest possible point, we'll burn all our fuel as quickly as we can to increase speed and inject Leonov into the orbit back to Earth. What's the point of such a crazy maneuver? It can't be justified except by highly complex mathematics, but I think the basic principle can be made fairly obvious. As we allow ourselves to fall into Jupiter's enormous gravity field, we'll gain velocity, and hence energy. When I say we, I mean the ships and the fuel they carry. And we're going to burn the fuel right there, at the bottom of Jupiter's gravity well. We're not going to lift it up again. As we blast it out from our reactors, it will share some of its acquired kinetic energy with us. Indirectly, we'll have tapped Jupiter's gravity to speed us on the way back to Earth. As we use the atmosphere to get rid of our excess velocity when we arrived, this is one of the rare cases when Mother Nature, usually so frugal, allows us to have it both ways. With this triple boost, Discovery's fuel, its own, and Jupiter's gravity, Leonov will head sunward along a hyperbola that will bring it to Earth 5 months later, at least 2 months earlier than we could have managed otherwise. You will doubtless wonder what will happen to the good old Discovery. Obviously, we can't bring it home under automatic control as we had originally planned. With no fuel, it will be helpless. But it will be perfectly safe. It will continue to loop round and round Jupiter on a highly elongated ellipse, like a trapped comet. And perhaps one day some future expedition may make another rendezvous with enough extra fuel to bring it back to Earth. However, that certainly won't happen for a good many years. And now we must get ready for our departure. There is still much work to be done, and we won't be able to relax until that final burn starts us on the homeward orbit. We won't be sorry to leave, even though we've not achieved all our objectives. The mystery, perhaps the threat, of Big Brother's disappearance still haunts us, but there's nothing we can do about that. We've done our best, and we're coming home. This is Haywood Floyd, signing off. There was a round of ironic clapping from his little audience, whose size would be multiplied many million-fold when the message reached Earth. "I'm not talking to you," retorted Floyd with slight embarrassment. "I didn't want you to hear it, anyway."
"You did your usual competent job, Haywood," said Tanya consolingly, "and I'm sure we all agree with everything you told the people back on Earth."
"Not quite," said a small voice, so softly that everyone had to strain in order to hear it. "There is still one problem."
The observation lounge suddenly became very silent. For the first time in weeks, Floyd became aware of the faint throbbing from the main air supply duct and the intermittent buzz that might have been made by a wasp trapped behind a wall panel. Leonov, like all spacecraft, was full of such often inexplicable sounds, which one seldom noticed except when they stopped. And then it was usually a good idea to start investigating without further ado.
"I'm not aware of any problem, Chandra," said Tanya in an ominously calm voice. "What could it possibly be?" I've spent the last few weeks preparing Hal to fly 1,000-day orbits back to Earth. Now all those programs will have to be dumped.
We're sorry about that, answered Tanya, but as things have turned out, surely this is a much better...
That's not what I meant, said Chandra. There was a ripple of astonishment. He had never before been known to interrupt anyone, least of all Tanya. We know how sensitive Hal is to mission objectives, he continued in the expectant hush that followed. Now you are asking me to give him a program that may result in his own destruction. It's true that the present plan will put Discovery into a stable orbit, but if that warning has any substance, what will happen to the ship eventually? We don't know, of course, but it scared us away. Have you considered Hal's reaction to this situation?
Are you seriously suggesting, Tanya asked very slowly, that Hal may refuse to obey orders, exactly as on the earlier mission?
That is not what happened last time. He did his best to interpret conflicting orders.
This time there need be no conflict. The situation is perfectly clear-cut.
To us, perhaps. But one of Hal's prime directives is to keep Discovery out of danger. We will be attempting to override that. And in a system as complex as Hal's, it is impossible to predict all the consequences.
I don't see any real problem, Sasha interjected. We just don't tell him that there is any danger. Then he'll have no reservations about carrying out his program. Babysitting a psychotic computer, muttered Kurnow. I feel I'm in a grade B science fiction video drama.
Dr. Chandra gave him an unfriendly glare.
Chandra, Tanya demanded suddenly, have you discussed this with Hal?
No.
Was there a slight hesitation? Floyd wondered. It might have been perfectly innocent. Chandra could have been checking his memory, or he could have been lying, improbable though that seemed.
Then we'll do what Sasha suggests. Just load the new program into him and leave it at that. And when he questions me about the change of plan...
Is he likely to do that without your prompting?
Of course. Please remember that he was designed for curiosity. If the crew was killed, he had to be capable of running a useful mission on his own initiative.
Tanya thought that over for a few moments.
It's still quite a simple matter. He'll believe you, won't he?
Certainly.
Then you must tell him that Discovery is in no danger and that there will be a rendezvous mission to bring it back to Earth at a later date.
But that is not true.
We don't know that it's false, replied Tanya, beginning to sound a little impatient.
We suspect that there is serious danger. Otherwise, we would not be planning to leave ahead of schedule.
Then what do you suggest? Tanya asked in a voice that now held a distinct note of menace.
We must tell him the whole truth, as far as we know it. No more lies or half-truths, which are just as bad. And then let him decide for himself.
Hell, Chandra! He's only a machine!
Chandra looked at Max with such a steady, confident gaze that the younger man quickly dropped his eyes.
So are we all, Mr. Brailovsky. It is merely a matter of degree. Whether we are based on carbon or on silicon makes no fundamental difference. We should each be treated with appropriate respect.
It was strange, thought Floyd, how Chandra, much the smallest person in the room, now seemed the largest. But the confrontation had gone on far too long. At any moment, Tanya would start to issue direct orders, and the situation would become really nasty.
Tanya, Vasily, can I have a word with you both? I think there is a way of resolving the problem.
Floyd's interruption was received with obvious relief, and 2 minutes later he was relaxing with the Orlovs in their quarters. Or 16th, as Kurnow had once christened them because of their size. He had soon regretted the pun because he had to explain it to everyone except Sasha.
Thank you, Woody, said Tanya, as she handed him a bulb of his favorite Azerbaijan chimaka.
I was hoping you'd do that.
I suppose you have something, how do you put it, up your sleeve?
I believe so, Floyd answered, squirting a few cubic centimeters of the sweet wine into his mouth and savoring it gratefully.
I'm sorry if Chandra is being difficult.
So am I. What a good thing we only have one mad scientist aboard.
That's not what you've sometimes told me, grinned academician Vasily. Anyway, Woody, let's have it.
This is what I suggest.
Let Chandra go ahead and do it his way. Then there are just two possibilities. First, Hal will do exactly what we ask, control discovery during the two firing periods. Remember, the first isn't critical. If something goes wrong while we're pulling away from Io, there's plenty of time to make corrections, and that will give us a good test of Hal's willingness to cooperate.
But what about the Jupiter flyby? That's the one that really counts. Not only do we burn most of Discovery's fuel there, but the timing and thrust vectors have to be exactly right.
Could they be controlled manually?
I'd hate to try. The slightest error, and we'd either burn up or become a long-period comet, due again in a couple of thousand years.
But if there was no alternative, Floyd insisted.
Well, assuming we could take control in time and had a good set of alternative orbits pre-computed, perhaps we might get away with it.
Knowing you, Vasily, I'm sure that might means would. Which leads me to the second possibility I mentioned. If Hal shows the slightest deviation from the program, we take over.
You mean disconnect him?
Exactly. That wasn't so easy last time. We've learned a few lessons since then. Leave it to me. I can guarantee to give you back manual control in about half a second.
There's no danger, I suppose, that Hal will suspect anything?
Now you're getting paranoid, Vasily. Hal's not that human, but Chandra is, to give him the benefit of the doubt. So don't say a word to him. We all agree with his plan completely, are sorry that we ever raised any objections, and are perfectly confident that Hal will see our point of view. Right, Tanya?
Right, Woody.
And I congratulate you on your foresight. That little gadget was a good idea.
What gadget? Asked Vasily.
I'll explain one of these days.
Sorry, Woody, that's all the Shimaka I have left. I want to save it until we're safely on the way to Earth.
Chapter 46, Countdown. No one would ever believe this without my photos, thought Max Brailovsky, as he orbited the two ships from half a kilometer away. It seems comically indecent, as if Leonov is raping Discovery. And now that he came to think of it, the rugged, compact Russian ship did look positively male when compared with the delicate, slender American one. But most docking operations had distinctly sexual overtones, and he remembered that one of the early cosmonauts, he couldn't recall the name, had been reprimanded for his too vivid choice of words at the climax of his mission. As far as he could tell from his careful survey, everything was in order. The task of positioning the two ships and securing them firmly together had taken longer than anticipated. It would never have been possible at all without one of those strokes of luck that sometimes, not always, favor those who deserve them. Leonov had providentially carried several kilometers of carbon filament tape, no bigger than the ribbon a girl might use to tie her hair, yet capable of taking a strain of many tons. It had been thoughtfully provided to secure instrument packages to Big Brother if all else failed. Now it wrapped Leonov and Discovery in tender embrace, sufficiently firmly, it was hoped, to prevent any rattlings and shakings at all accelerations up to one-tenth of a gravity that was the maximum that full thrust could provide.
"Anything more you want me to check before I come home?" asked Max.
"No," replied Tanya. "Everything looks fine, and we can't waste any more time."
That was true enough. If that mysterious warning was to be taken seriously, and everyone now took it very seriously indeed, they should start their escape maneuver within the next 24 hours.
Right. I'm bringing Nina back to the stable. Sorry about this, old girl.
You never told us Nina was a horse.
I'm not admitting it now, and I feel bad about dumping her here in space just to give us a miserable few extra meters per second.
We may be very glad of them in a few hours, Max. Anyway, there's always a chance that someone may come and pick her up again one day.
I very much doubt it, thought Max.
And perhaps, after all, it was appropriate to leave the little space pod there as a permanent reminder of man's first visit to the kingdom of Jupiter.
With gentle, carefully timed pulses from the control jets, he brought Nina around the great sphere of Discovery's main life support module. His colleagues in the flight deck barely glanced at him as he drifted past their curving window. The open pod bay door yawned before him, and he jockeyed Nina delicately down onto the extended docking arm.
"Pull me in," he said, as soon as the latches had clicked shut. "I call that a well-planned EVA.
There's a whole kilogram of propellant left to take Nina out for the last time. Normally, there was little drama about a burn in deep space. It was not like the fire and thunder, and always present risks of a liftoff from a planetary surface. If something went wrong and the motors failed to come up to full thrust, well, matters could usually be corrected by a slightly longer burn, or one could wait until the appropriate point in orbit and try again. But this time, as the countdown proceeded towards zero, the tension aboard both ships was almost palpable. Everyone knew that it was the first real test of HAL's docility. Only Floyd, Curnow, and the Orlovs realized that there was a backup system, and even they were not absolutely sure that it would work. "Good luck, Leonov," said Mission Control, timing the message to arrive 5 minutes before ignition. "Hope everything's running smoothly. And if it's not too much trouble, could you please get some close-ups of the equator, longitude 115, as you go around Jupiter? There's a curious dark spot there, presumably some kind of upwelling, perfectly round, almost 1,000 kilometers across. Looks like the shadow of a satellite, but it can't be." Tanya made a brief acknowledgement that managed to convey, in a remarkably few words, a profound lack of interest in the meteorology of Jupiter at that moment. Mission Control sometimes showed a perfect genius for tactlessness and poor timing. "All systems functioning normally," said Hal. 2 minutes to ignition. Strange, thought Floyd, how terminology often survives long after the technology that gave it birth. Only chemical rockets were capable of ignition, even if the hydrogen in a nuclear or plasma drive did come into contact with oxygen, it would be far too hot to burn. At such temperatures, all compounds were stripped back into their elements. His mind wandered, seeking other examples. People, particularly older ones, still spoke of putting film into a camera or gas into a car. Even the phrase "cutting a tape" was still sometimes heard in recording studios, though that embraced two generations of obsolete technologies. 1 minute to ignition. His mind flashed back to the here and now. This was the minute that counted. For almost 100 years, on launch pads and in control centers, this was the longest 60 seconds that had ever existed. Countless times it had ended in disaster, but only the triumphs were remembered. Which will ours be? The temptation to put his hand once more into the pocket that held the activator for the cutout switch was almost irresistible, even though logic told him there was plenty of time for remedial action. If Hal failed to obey his programming, that would be a nuisance, not a disaster. The really critical time would be when they were rounding Jupiter. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Ignition. At first, the thrust was barely perceptible. It took almost a minute to build up to the full tenth of a G. Nevertheless, everyone started clapping immediately until Tanya signaled for silence. There were many checks to be made, even if Hal was doing his best, as he certainly seemed to be. There was so much that could still go wrong. Discovery's antenna mount, which was now taking most of the strain from Leonov's inertia, had never been intended for such mistreatment. The ship's chief designer, called out of retirement, had sworn that the safety margin was adequate. But he might be wrong, and materials had been known to become brittle after years in space. And the tapes holding the two ships together might not have been located accurately. They might stretch or slip. Discovery might not be able to correct for the off-center mass, now that it was carrying 1,000 tons piggyback. Floyd could imagine 12 things that could go wrong. It was little consolation to remember that it was always the 13th that actually happened. But the minutes dragged on uneventfully. The only proof that Discovery's engines were operating was the fractional thrust-induced gravity and a very slight vibration transmitted through the walls of the ships. Io and Jupiter still hung where they had been for weeks, on opposite sides of the sky. Cut off in 10 seconds. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. Now. Thank you, Hal. On the button. Now, that was another phrase that was badly dated. For at least a generation, touchpads had almost entirely replaced buttons, but not for all applications.
In critical cases, it was best to have a device that moved perceptibly, with a nice, satisfying click.
I confirmed that, said Vasily. No need for any corrections until mid-course.
Say goodbye to glamorous exotic Io, real estate agent's dream world, said Kurnow. We'll all be happy to miss you.
That sounds more like the old Walter, Floyd told himself. For the last few weeks, he had been oddly subdued, as if he had something on his mind. But who did not? He seemed to spend a good deal of his scanty free time in quiet discussions with Katerina. Floyd hoped that he had not developed some medical problem. They had been very lucky so far on that score. The last thing they needed at this stage was an emergency that required the surgeon commander's expertise.
You're being unkind, Walter, said Brailovsky. I was beginning to like the place. It might be fun to go boating on those lava lakes.
What about a volcano barbecue?
Or genuine molten sulfur baths?
Everyone was lighthearted, even a little hysterical with relief, though it was far too early to relax, and the most critical phase of the escape maneuver still lay ahead. The first step had been safely taken on the long journey home. That was cause enough for a little modest rejoicing. It did not last long, for Tanya quickly ordered all those not on essential duty to get some rest, if possible some sleep, in preparation for the Jupiter swing by only 9 hours ahead. When those addressed were slow to move, Sasha cleared the decks by shouting,
"You'll hang for this, you mutinous dogs!"
Only two nights before, as a rare relaxation, they had all enjoyed the fourth version of Mutiny on the Bounty, generally agreed by movie historians to have the best Captain Bligh since the fabled Charles Laughton. There was some feeling on board that Tanya should not have seen it, lest it give her ideas. After a couple of restless hours in his cocoon, Floyd abandoned the quest for sleep and wandered up to the observation deck. Jupiter was much larger and slowly waning as the ships hurtled toward their closest approach over the night side. A glorious gibbous disk, it showed such an infinite wealth of detail. Cloud belts, spots of every color from dazzling white to brick red, dark upwellings from the unknown depths, the cyclonic oval of the great red spot, that the eye could not possibly absorb at all. The round dark shadow of one moon, probably Europa, Floyd guessed, was in transit. He was seeing this incredible sight for the last time. Even though he had to be at maximum efficiency in 6 hours, it was a crime to waste precious moments in sleep. Where was that spot that Mission Control had asked them to observe? It should have been coming into view, but Floyd was not sure if it would be visible to the naked eye. Vasily would be too busy to bother about it. Perhaps he could help by doing a little amateur astronomy. There had, after all, been a brief time, only 30 years ago, when he had earned his living as a professional. He activated the controls of the main 50-centimeter telescope. Fortunately, the field of view was not blocked by the adjacent bulk of Discovery, and scanned along the equator at medium power. And there it was, just coming over the edge of the disk. By force of circumstance, Floyd was now one of the solar system's 10 greatest experts on Jupiter. The other 9 were working or sleeping around him. He saw at once that there was something very odd about this spot. It was so black that it looked like a hole punched through the clouds. From his point of view, it appeared to be a sharp-edged ellipse. Floyd guessed that from directly above, it would be a perfect circle. He recorded a few images, then increased the power to maximum. Already, Jupiter's rapid spin had brought the formation into clearer view, and the more he stared, the more puzzled Floyd became. Vasily, he called over the intercom, if you can spare a minute, have a look at the 50-centimeter monitor.
What are you observing? Is it important? I'm checking the orbit.
Take your time, of course, but I found that spot, Mission Control reported. It looks very peculiar.
Hell, I'd forgotten all about it. We're a fine lot of observers if those guys back on Earth have to tell us where to look. Give me another 5 minutes. It won't run away.
True enough, thought Floyd. In fact, it will get clearer. And there was no disgrace in missing something that terrestrial, or lunar, astronomers had observed. Jupiter was very big. They had been very busy, and the telescopes on the moon and in Earth orbit were 100 times more powerful than the instrument he was using now. But this was getting more and more peculiar. For the first time, Floyd began to feel a distinct sense of unease. Until that moment, it had never occurred to him that the spot could be anything but a natural formation, some trick of Jupiter's incredibly complex meteorology. Now he began to wonder. It was so black, like night itself, and so symmetrical,
As it came into clearer view, it was obviously a perfect circle. Yet it was not sharply defined. The edge had an odd fuzziness, as if it was a little out of focus. Was it imagination, or had it grown, even while he was watching? He made a quick estimate and decided that the thing was now 2,000 kilometers across. It was only a little smaller than the still visible shadow of Europa, but was so much darker that there was no risk of confusion.
"Let's have a look," said Vasily, in a rather condescending tone. "What do you think you found?"
"Oh." His voice trailed away into silence.
"This is it," thought Floyd, with a sudden icy conviction. "Whatever it may be."
Chapter 47. Final Flyby. Yet on further reflection, after the initial amazement had worn off, it was hard to see how a spreading black stain on the face of Jupiter could represent any kind of danger. It was extraordinary, inexplicable, but not as important as the critical events now only 7 hours in the future. A successful burn at Perijove was all that mattered. They would have plenty of time to study mysterious black spots on the way home. And to sleep. Floyd had given up all attempts at that, though the feeling of danger, at least of known danger, was much less than on their first approach to Jupiter. A mixture of excitement and apprehension kept him wide awake. The excitement was natural and understandable. The apprehension had more complex causes. Floyd made it a rule never to worry about events over which he could have absolutely no control. Any external threat would reveal itself in due time and must be dealt with then. But he could not help wondering if they had done everything possible to safeguard the ships. Apart from onboard mechanical failures, there were two main sources of concern. Although the tapes that secured Leonov and Discovery together had shown no tendency to slip, their severest test was still to come. Almost equally critical would be the moment of separation when the smallest of the explosive charges, once intended to jolt Big Brother, would be used at uncomfortably close quarters. And, of course, there was Hal. He'd carried out the deorbiting maneuver with exquisite precision. He had run the simulations of the Jupiter flyby right down to Discovery's last drop of fuel without any comments or objections. And although Chandra, as agreed, had carefully explained what they were trying to do, did Hal really understand what was happening? Floyd had one overriding concern, which in the preceding few days had become almost an obsession. He could picture everything going perfectly, the ships halfway through the final maneuver, the enormous disk of Jupiter filling the sky only a few hundred kilometers below them, and then Hal electronically clearing his throat and saying, "Dr. Chandra, do you mind if I ask you a question?" It did not happen exactly that way. The Great Black Spot, as it had been inevitably christened, was now being carried out of sight by Jupiter's swift rotation. In a few hours, the still accelerating ships would catch up with it over the night side of the planet, but this was the last chance for a close daylight observation. It was still growing at an extraordinary speed. In the last 2 hours, it had more than doubled its area. Except for the fact that it retained its blackness as it expanded, it resembled an ink stain spreading in water. Its boundary, now moving at near-sonic speed in the Jovian atmosphere, still looked curiously fuzzy and out of focus. At the very highest power of the ship's telescope, the reason for this was at last apparent. Unlike the Great Red Spot, the Great Black Spot was not a continuous structure. It was built up from myriads of tiny dots, like a half-tone print viewed through a magnifying glass. Over most of its area, the dots were so closely spaced that they were almost touching, but at the rim they became more and more widely spaced, so that the spot ended in a gray penumbra rather than at a sharp frontier. There must have been almost a million of the mysterious dots, and they were distinctly elongated, ellipses rather than circles. Katerina, the least imaginative person aboard, surprised everybody by saying that it looked as if someone had taken a sackful of rice, dyed it black, and poured it on the face of Jupiter. And now the sun was dropping down behind the huge, swiftly narrowing arch of the dayside, as for the second time Leonov raced into the Jovian night for an appointment with Destiny. In less than 30 minutes the final burn would commence, and things would start to happen very quickly indeed. Floyd wondered if he should have joined Chandra and Kurnow, standing watch on Discovery. But there was nothing he could do. In an emergency, he would only be in the way. The cutoff switch was in Kurnow's pocket, and Floyd knew that the younger man's reactions were a good deal swifter than his own. If Hal showed the slightest sign of misbehavior, he could be disconnected in less than a second. But Floyd felt certain that such extreme measures would not be necessary. Since he had been allowed to do things his own way, Chandra had cooperated completely in setting up the procedures for a manual takeover, should that unfortunate necessity arise. Floyd was confident that he could be trusted to carry out his duty, however much he might regret the need. Kurnow was not quite so sure. He would be happier, he had told Floyd, if he had multiple redundancy in the form of a second cutoff switch for Chandra. Meanwhile, there was nothing that anyone could do but wait and watch the approaching cloudscape of the nightside, dimly visible by the reflected light of passing satellites, the glow of petrochemical reactions, and frequent titanic lighting flashes from thunderstorms larger than Earth. The sun winked out behind them, eclipsed in seconds by the immense globe they were so swiftly approaching. When they saw it again, they should be on their way home. 20 minutes to ignition. All systems nominal. Thank you, Hal. I wonder if Chandra was being quite truthful, thought Kurnow, when he said that Hal would be confused if anyone else spoke to him. I've talked to him often enough, when nobody was around, and he always understood me perfectly. Still, there's not much time left for friendly conversation now, though it would help to reduce the strain. What's Hal really thinking, if he thinks, about the mission? All his life, Kurnow had shied away from abstract philosophical questions. I'm a nuts and bolts man, he had often claimed, though there were not too many of either in a spaceship. Once he would have laughed at the idea, but now he began to wonder. Did Hal sense that he would soon be abandoned? And if so, would he resent it? Kurnow almost reached for the cutoff switch in his pocket, but checked himself. He had already done this so often that Chandra might be getting suspicious. For the 100th time, he rehearsed the sequence of events that were due to take place during the next hour. The moment that Discovery's fuel was exhausted, they would close down all but essential systems and dash back to Leonov through the connecting tube. That would be decoupled, the explosive charges would be fired, the ships would drift apart, and Leonov's own engines would start to fire. The separation should take place, if everything went according to plan, just when they were making their closest approach to Jupiter. That would take maximum advantage of the planet's gravitational largesse. 15 minutes to ignition. All systems nominal. Thank you, Hal. By the way, said Vasily from the other ship, we are catching up with the great black spot again. Wonder if we can see anything new. I rather hope not, thought Kurnow. We've got quite enough on our hands at the moment. Nevertheless, he gave a quick glance at the image Vasily was transmitting on the telescope monitor. At first, he could see nothing except the faintly glimmering night side of the planet. Then he saw on the horizon a foreshortened circle of deeper darkness. They were rushing toward it with incredible speed. Vasily increased the light amplification, and the entire image brightened magically. At last, the great black spot resolved itself into its myriad identical elements. My God, thought Kurnow, I just don't believe it. He heard exclamations of surprise from Leonov. All the others had shared in the same revelation at the same moment. Dr. Chandra, said Hal, I detect strong vocal stress patterns. Is there a problem? No, Hal, Chandra answered quickly. The mission is proceeding normally. We've just had rather a surprise, that's all. What do you make of the image on monitor circuit 16? I see the night side of Jupiter. There is a circular area 3,250 kilometers in diameter, which is almost completely covered with rectangular objects. How many? There was the briefest of pauses before Hal flashed the number on the video display. 1,355,000 plus or minus 1,000. And do you recognize them? Yes, they are identical in size and shape to the object you refer to as Big Brother. 10 minutes to ignition. All systems nominal. Mine aren't, thought Kurnow. So the damn thing's gone down to Jupiter and multiplied. There was something simultaneously comic and sinister about a plague of black monoliths, and to his puzzled surprise, that incredible image on the monitor screen had a certain weird familiarity. Of course, that was it.
Those myriad identical black rectangles reminded him of dominoes. Years ago, he had seen a video documentary showing how a team of slightly crazy Japanese had patiently stood a million dominoes on end, so that when the very first one was toppled, all the others would inevitably follow. They'd been arranged in complex patterns, some underwater, some up and down little stairways, others along multiple tracks, so that they formed pictures and patterns as they fell. It had taken weeks to set them up. Kernow remembered now that earthquakes had several times foiled the enterprise, and the final toppling from first domino to the last had taken more than an hour. 8 minutes to ignition. All systems nominal. Dr. Chandra, may I make a suggestion?
What is it, Hal?
This is a very unusual phenomenon. Do you not think I should abort the countdown so that you can remain to study it? Aboard Leonov, Floyd started to move quickly toward the bridge. Tanya and Vasily might be needing him, not to mention Chandra and Kernow. What a situation! And suppose Chandra took Hal's side? If he did, they might both be right. After all, was this not the very reason they had come here? If they stopped the countdown, the ships would loop around Jupiter and be back at precisely the same spot in 19 hours. A 19-hour hold would create no problems. If it was not for that enigmatic warning, he would have strongly recommended it himself. But now they had very much more than a warning. Below them was a planetary plague spreading across the face of Jupiter. Perhaps they were indeed running away from the most extraordinary phenomenon in the history of science. Even so, he preferred to study it from a safer distance.
6 minutes to ignition, said Hal. All systems nominal. I am ready to stop the countdown if you agree.
Let me remind you that my prime directive is to study everything in Jupiter's space that may be connected with intelligence. Floyd recognized that phrase all too well. He had written it himself. He wished he could delete it from Hal's memory. A moment later, he had reached the bridge and joined the Orlovs. They both looked at him with alarmed concern.
What do you recommend? Asked Tanya swiftly.
It's up to Chandra, I'm afraid. Can I speak to him on the private line? Vasily handed over the microphone. Chandra, I assume that Hal can't hear this.
Correct, Dr. Floyd.
You've got to talk quickly, persuading that the countdown must continue, that we appreciate his scientific enthusiasm. That's the right angle. Say we're confident that he can do the job without our help, and we'll be in touch with him all the time, of course.
5 minutes to ignition. All systems nominal.
I am still waiting for your answer, Dr. Chandra. So are we all, thought Kernow, only a meter away from the scientist, and if I do have to push that button at last, it will be something of a relief. In fact, I'll rather enjoy it.
Very well, Hal. Continue the countdown. I have every confidence in your ability to study all phenomena in Jupiter space without our supervision. Of course, we will be in touch with you at all times.
4 minutes to ignition. All systems nominal. Propellant tank pressurization completed. Voltage steady on plasma trigger.
Are you sure you are making the right decision, Dr. Chandra? I enjoy working with human beings and have a stimulating relationship with them.
Ship's attitude correct to 0.1 milliradian.
We enjoy working with you, Hal. And we will still be doing so, even if we are millions of kilometers away.
3 minutes to ignition. All systems nominal. Radiation shielding checked. There is the problem of the time lag, Dr. Chandra. It may be necessary to consult each other without any delay.
This is insane, Kernow thought, his hands now never far from the cutoff switch. I really believe that Hal is lonely. Is he mimicking some part of Chandra's personality that we never suspected?
The lights flickered so imperceptibly that only someone familiar with every nuance of Discovery's behavior would have noticed. It could be good news or bad. The plasma firing sequence started, or being terminated. He risked a quick glance at Chandra. The little scientist's face was drawn and haggard, and for almost the first time, Kernow felt real sympathy for him as another human being. And he remembered the startling information that Floyd had confided in him. Chandra's offer to stay with the ship and keep Hal company on the 3-year voyage home. He had heard no more of the idea, and presumably it had been quietly forgotten after the warning.
But perhaps Chandra was being tempted again. If he was, there was nothing that he could do about it at that stage. There would be no time to make the necessary preparations, even if they stayed on for another orbit and delayed their departure beyond the deadline, which Tanya would certainly not permit after all that had now happened.
"Hal," whispered Chandra so quietly that Kurnow could scarcely hear him, "we have to leave. I don't have time to give you all the reasons, but I can assure you it's true."
2 minutes to ignition. All systems nominal. Final sequence started. "I am sorry that you are unable to stay. Can you give me some of the reasons, in order of importance?"
"Not in 2 minutes, Hal. Proceed with the countdown. I will explain everything later. We still have more than an hour. Together."
Hal did not answer. The silence stretched on and on. Surely the 1 minute announcement was overdue. Kurnow glanced at the clock.
"My God," he thought, "Hal's missed it. Has he stopped the countdown?"
Kurnow's hand fumbled uncertainly for the switch.
"What do I do now? I wish Floyd would say something, damn it, but he's probably afraid of making things worse. I'll wait until time zero. No, it's not that critical. Let's say an extra minute, then I'll zap him and we'll go over to manual."
From far, far away, there came a faint whistling scream like the sound of a tornado marching just below the edge of the horizon. Discovery started to vibrate. There was the first intimation of returning gravity. "Ignition," said Hal. "Full thrust at T plus 15 seconds.
"Thank you, Hal," replied Chandra.